Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this holiday edition of Risky Business. We're running short format, pre-recorded shows until the 9th of October while I'm overseas on holiday, so there won't be any news headlines this week. But not to worry, we've got plenty of great interviews in the can. Coming up later, we'll be speaking to Verizon Business Security Solutions Vice President Peter Tippett about quantifying risk. Peter has been around for a long time now, and he's got some interesting perspectives there. That's our sponsor interview, and it's coming along later. First up, however, we'll be hearing from Symantec's Vincent Weifer. He's the company's Senior Global Director of its Security Response Department. We'll be talking to Vincent about some of the things Symantec's up to, developing security software that runs in virtualized environments, for instance. We'll also be talking about the general nastiness in the environment out there. I started by asking Vincent why Symantec is developing security software that runs, fully virtualized, on Intel's new vPro platform.
By working in a virtualized environment, we can actually run a number of activities and keep them fairly secure. The key thing here is we need to be running as close to hardware as possible and not be reliant on applications or APIs to provide us trusted information. The closer we get to the hardware, the better. Stealth, the ability to evade detection, is a critical factor for many of today's malicious code. So being able to stay one step ahead of that by being able to identify it, stopping it getting the system, and in the case of, say, user mode rootkits or kernel mode, being as close to the underlying hardware as possible is critical for us to be able to defend the system.
And I suppose it would help in case you'd been rootkitted by some sort of virtualization layer like the blue pill scenario. Is that a part of it as well?
It's absolutely looking at those sort of scenarios because, again, we want to make sure that our security protection, we're very proud of the fact that we've been in kernel mode protection for a long time, means we've been able to stay underneath these rootkits and be very effective at detecting and blocking them getting on the system. And so we're looking at the virtualization technologies and we're looking to see how do we best protect the users by using these newer technologies. And we're also looking at not just in terms of that technology, but the implications of virtualizations of VMware or any other technologies, and what it means in terms of security, and as people are deploying that, making sure they're not exposing themselves unnecessarily.
Vincent, before we started the interview, you were expressing some concerns over the pace of innovation in the, I suppose you call it the digital underworld. You know, the malware writers seem to be rapidly developing some new tricks. Would you say that's the case?
Even by volume alone, we're looking at, for the first 6 months of this year compared to the last 6 months of last year, almost a 200% increase in the volume of the number of threats we're seeing. We're looking at types of threats such as PCOM or Stormworm. We're looking at Rustoc. We're looking at very sophisticated multi-stage attacks, which are very dynamic and, of course, are using stealth, resiliency, and many other techniques to try and avoid detection and get themselves out.
Well, the Stormworm itself is a bit of a curiosity, isn't it? Because we've been told that the days of these worms and viruses that were going to spread to millions of computers were over. And that's what companies like Symantec, Trend, you know, all of the larger sort of AV companies had been saying. And then Storm comes along and starts knocking over millions of machines.
Well, what you're looking at with examples such as Rustoc and Storm and those are a little bit different from the traditional let's get out mass mail and hit every system at once. You're looking at very resilient multi-stage attacks. So I get it out there, I infect a number of systems, and of course then I have my payload, which I can use for denial of service attacks, for spam. It becomes a different type of challenge for the enterprise environment in that they're very resilient, very persistent, but it's not necessarily the same initial infection which is causing all the problems.
Now, one interesting little bit of information here that we discussed prior to this interview is that you say bank account credentials are now worth around the same as a bunch of login credentials for an internet service provider on the underground market.
We're definitely seeing a change in the underground market. So they're valuing information based on qualifications and quality. So, for example, a bank account that has an unknown a number of money, or if it's even an active account, is obviously worth a lot less than a bank account which is highly qualified and got money. But so too is a ISP account and password, because they can actually make a lot of money with that account over time, be it spam, phishing, fraud. So they've learned how to use this raw material and create wealth out of it. And So it's not just our credit card numbers or bank accounts. It's the broader information that they value because they can use it in multiple attacks. Clearly, they can take over your identity and create spam and kick out. They may even take your identity to log in some of your addresses, maybe travel, maybe online trade, pump and dump, click fraud. There's a number of techniques they can use for us. But effectively, they've assumed your identity and are using that. Now, the attackers have also changed their attacks to not necessarily abuse that straight away, but do it, I call it slow and low, over a longer period of time, maximize the profit potential of that asset, and use it in multiple different types of attacks, not a single attack.
You're listening to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray, and we're talking to Symantec's Vincent Weaver. With free antivirus available these days, courtesy of products like AVG Free, and with Microsoft moving in on the endpoint security market, some are saying the rivers of revenue flowing into the coffers of companies like Symantec and McAfee through AV and endpoint security software sales are going to dry up. While Symantec is keeping mum on how much of its revenue is derived from endpoint security agents and AV, Vincent Weaver was happy to discuss the topic in general.
Well, Symantec has really evolved into endpoint security. So think Norton Internet Security, Norton 360 on the consumer side, or the about-to-be-released endpoint protection on the enterprise side. So this is a key point we're discussing, which is if we look at the current threat landscape in terms of how they've evolved over the years, you're really not talking about virus and worms. In fact, even over the last 3 years, they've gone from being 90% of the malicious code we see out there to being less than 10% today. So we've really changed the technology to deal with that balance. What you're going to see from Symantec in the next year or two is a much more aggressive move towards real-time protection, behavioral protection-type technologies, rather than signature protection-type technologies. So the number of virus deaths, literally, when you look at the maths, you can't keep up with the number of signatures that maybe have to be delivered for the volume of threats we see today.
What proportion of revenue then comes from endpoint security solutions?
It's still a very important part of us. I don't have the figures. We can pass it over to the marketing sales guys. But it is a core foundation of Symantec. We will continue to make it a core foundation, but we're going to build upon this. Because if you think about with phishing, fraud, and other protections, we constantly add around us. So today, if you look at the latest edition of Norton Antivirus, it has probably 9 different engines underneath the hood dealing with today's threats.
But I imagine now that Microsoft's really jumping into the sort of endpoint protection game, it's going to make it tricky, isn't it, for Symantec? And I know we've been saying this for years, that Microsoft's going to get in the game and it's all over for Symantec and Trend and, you know, all of the big antivirus companies. But obviously with that software responsible for pulling in so much revenue for a company that is so large like Symantec, you've really got to be thinking about some fairly radical long-term strategies.
Well, what we're actually all hoping, and we haven't seen the impact of Microsoft in the market yet, even after there have now been 5 years in terms of having RAV technology, been in the market for about 2 years, we're not seeing them out there. But the hope is, at least on the consumer side, we end up growing the market and growing awareness around us. So in other words, the slice of the pie gets bigger. And that's exactly what we're seeing at the moment, is that as more people are getting in there, we're getting more awareness, it looks like that everybody is kind of winning in this space. But we believe Symantec has the technology, the security expertise, and the operational experience to stay ahead of any competitor, including people such as Microsoft.
What are some of the challenges involved in creating software that really restricts certain actions on that computer through behavioral modeling? I mean, how easy is it to profile what is and what isn't normal behavior?
Behavioral modeling or real-time protection based on behavior-based technologies is really challenging. As we know, we've had these technologies out there for the last 10 years, but they've never gone beyond the early adopters because of the number of false alerts, because of the number of alerts, because of the decisions that we're pushing onto the end user who are not qualified to make these decisions. So the challenge with these latest generations is, how do I mix that in with signature and other protection so at the end of the day, I can make the decision for the user and not simply push that responsibility onto them? How do I do it with low false positives, and how do I do it and not impact system performance? That, we believe, is the challenge. Much like the suite model back in the 90s, which was how do you bring a number of technologies and make it simpler, we believe that's still the same challenge we have today.
Well, and the primary challenge, I guess, is you're dealing with users who, when they see a pop-up from a piece of security software, they don't see the yes or no button. They see the let me do what I want to do and don't let me do what I want to do buttons. I mean, isn't that one of the problems?
That's certainly one of the problems in terms of the users will always want to get to their favorite game or favorite system. However, we believe that as a security company, we should be helping make these decisions. So in other words, if something is deemed to be a security risk, we should take care of it and not simply push a pop-up and ask them what you want to do next. So as we deploy these behavioral-based technologies, the goal is how do you do it in a way that is less intrusive, has less performance impact, and in fact, in many ways, is easier with less intrusiveness to the user.
So it's sort of take charge, virile, anti-malware.
That's what we're trying to do in terms of the making the user experience better and making security back more of the background rather than the foreground in terms of forcing them to make lots of decisions.
There's some companies out there already doing this stuff. I mean, EI Digital Security has some software. I can't really remember. Is it Retina or?
There's a number of companies already out doing this. But what the challenge to have beyond going from the enterprise or from the early adopters is the average user doesn't get this. They're being asked to make too many decisions. It's too technical. Think of firewalls in the beginning. Firewalls popped up all these alerts to say that foo.exe is trying to access port 52. What is port 52 and what's foo.exe? So as we're trying to deploy these out there, we're trying to be smarter about the firewalls, decision-making, so that we're not forcing these things onto users who aren't qualified to make these decisions.
Do you think Microsoft may have made an error in judgment when designing its universal access control interface for Vista?
I think this is a challenge. We understand why they did it, and certainly you can look at Unix and their systems, which have a similar sort of pop-up, are you okay, I'm administrator for us. But in terms of user feedback, a lot of people have commented on too many pops up, what does it mean? And I think that's something they're probably going to be working on, as to how to make it less intrusive for the users, but at the same time giving them enough awareness about the security decisions they're making.
Vincent Weifer, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Symantec's Vincent Weifer there, speaking to Risky Business at the company's Vision User Conference in Sydney last week. And because disclosure is important, I should mention that Symantec flew me to the event and provided my accommodation in Sydney. We'll be right back after this short break.
Are you at risk of data leakage? How many portable storage devices are being used in your organisation? Download the PointSec Device Discovery Tool from pointsec.com/device-discovery-tool to identify removable devices connected to your computers and find out where you might be vulnerable.
It's time for this week's sponsor interview. This week we're talking to Verizon Business Security Solutions Vice President Peter Tippett about quantifying risk.
Most of us have been trained by our peers and by our technology history to think about things in binary terms, and risk is very much an analog concept. And we worry about vulnerability instead of worrying about risk, and vulnerability tends to be a binary thought. We tend to think in single computer terms. That is, we tend to take what works for a single computer and try and apply it to an enterprise. That's kind of like applying the individual doctoring to a whole country. You know, if you're going to fix cholera in some country, you do it by putting the toilets on one side of the road and the drinking water on the other, instead of treating each person who gets it or preventing each person individually.
Well, it's interesting you mention that. We had on the show, we had Adrian Lamo, who is the so-called homeless hacker. And perhaps the most interesting thing he had to say was that security really isn't about the security of individual systems. It's much more to do with the security of the plurality, and that's a difficult state to arrive at. Is that something you agree with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the risk equation that we've used at Verizon Business now for since its early inception was where risk is thought of in terms of dollars per year, in terms of annual loss expectancy. And if you think of it in those terms, then the right side of the equation has to have dollars and years in it. And so the right side of the equation is threat, which is a frequency. That's the per year part. The impact, which is the total, you know, all the various bad things that might happen, and that's the dollar part. And then the vulnerability is a number between 0 and 1, which is the likelihood of success of a given threat versus the enterprise, not versus a computer or versus a particular application. And because we have many other things going on, every enterprise has some firewalls and some routers and some rules and some user education and some this and some of that. the combination of all those countermeasures has some beneficial impact against virtually any attack. So nobody is 100% vulnerable, and nobody is 100% secure. And really the game becomes adding layers of things that are nowhere near 100% each. But at the enterprise level, you can get some pretty inexpensive things distributed that might be 70 or 80% effective against a particular threat scenario.
But how do we quantify those numbers, like 80% effective against a, you know, given threat scenario? How do we actually put hard numbers onto these concepts, which are really difficult to quantify?
Well, there's a couple of tricks in this, and at the Verizon CyberTrust Group, we've spent a lot of time figuring out how to do this. And for example, we've done a study that came up with this is the third or fourth study that came up with the same surprising results. So we're beginning to believe them. If you ask the question, how powerful is a firewall against hacking-related threats? Most of us would say, well, firewalls generally do a pretty good job against most hacking-related threats. And if you take the group of hacking-related threats as a group, and firewalls, however deployed as a group, it's easy enough to measure the likelihood of some types of threats getting past typical firewall deployments. And they typically run 90% effective or so against most hacking-related things. They're not 99 or 99.9 at the enterprise level, because hacking can happen in the enterprise level against machines that are traveling and all the other things that we worry about.
But what about things like, you know, client-side exploits, which, you know, really firewalls don't do anything to protect you against?
Exactly, and that becomes part of the 10% that firewalls don't help much.
Well, this is sort of what I'm getting at here, is once you deploy a countermeasure, you know, people work around it. So we deployed firewalls. All of a sudden, people stopped hacking daemons on systems, and they started going for the client-side exploits.
Well, now, wait a minute. They didn't stop hacking daemons on. They're still, by far, the biggest traffic that we see on the backbone is still the SQL Slammer and Blaster and all kinds of directed attacks that are port-wise attacks. There's still huge amounts of those. Mm. The fact is that the majority of them bounce off, but that doesn't mean that the attack rate has gone down. The attack rate is pretty good on those things. They don't work as well because our countermeasures have increased in that arena. And, of course, we've added more attacks that are client-driven, and where the client gets himself shot in the foot by going to nasty places or whatever.
Mm.
But of course, outbound firewall rules help those as well. If you get infected by a bot, even if you get infected, even a simple router rule that keeps outbound traffic from working in certain ways, default deny egress filtering, is extremely powerful against the problem to the enterprise, even though the machine might be infected.
So I guess what you're saying is, despite the inherent complexities involved with calculating the likelihood of certain attacks, you can sort of apply an average here.
Yeah, well, the trick is to narrow the question to particular threat scenarios. So just now we've been talking about two broad threat scenario categories, one sort of inbound hacking type threats, and the other, the sort of user goes out and gets himself attacked by browsing nasty places type attacks. And as long as you narrow the threat scenarios sufficiently so that the attack pathways and vectors and so on are similar, then you can ask the question about that particular grouping of attacks in the scenario. And for each of the scenarios, you can say, well, firewalls don't work very well for that one. They certainly don't work well for someone walking into the server room and walking off with the hard drive.
Mm.
There's all no countermeasures work across broad arrays of attacks. There just aren't any particular ones. And so the trick is to lay all the various threat scenarios in a grid. And in the grid at Verizon CyberTrust, we have about 5,000 categories of threat. You know, and they're broadly broken down into malcode and hacking and downtime and physical and human factors types attacks, those sorts of categories. We put compliance in with an attack scenario, because if you put compliance in with all the others, it turns out you balance the spending for compliance against the spending for other things.
Mm.
And then across the other part of the grid, it is the who does the attacking and by which pathways does it get there. Which kinds of machines or systems does it get to, and what kinds of bad outcomes does it lead to? That's a five-dimensional matrix, that has about 5,000 cells in it. But when you, and so it isn't easy. I'm not suggesting that doing this is easy.
So what would you say is really the main advantage to being able to quantify your risk in this particular way? Is it just useful to be able to see where you're weak and which technical deficiencies are leading to the greatest risk?
Right. There's two big things that come of it. One is that you discover that countermeasures that everybody touts turn out to, many of them turn out to be not as strong as we all expected.
So
for example, rapid patching. Rapid reactive patching is not in the top 20 list of the most useful things to do in enterprises for hacking and malcode related attacks. And it's just the opposite of what we mostly tell each other. And we hypothesized this about 5 years ago. But since then, we've done now a total of 7 studies that all came to the same answer in studies. Some of the studies, for example, were for the Sasser and Blaster worms, where people who did a better than average job of patching wound up with a worse than average attack cost and impact.
And how did that work?
But just that's the data. And then we did a study, the most recent study we did, we went to about 350 companies randomly and asked them how well they did on a 0 to 5 scale. Well, 0 is I don't do the countermeasure at all, and 5 is I do the best job anybody could in the world of the particular countermeasure. And we went through a total of 60 different countermeasures with these 350 companies, and we also got a good history for the kinds of attacks that succeeded and so on. And we did simple correlation analysis between which countermeasures correlated with which kinds of attacks across that group of enterprises. And it turned out that a patching average versus patching aggressively, if you did the level 5 best in the world type patching, it was not any better. It did not correlate with reducing risk of hacking and malcode. So that was the 7th study that's had something to say in that space. And it boils down to the fact that every countermeasure has a sweet spot. Doing updates of your antivirus more often than about weekly or even monthly doesn't reduce risk compared to doing a good job monthly. Updating, patching, doing quarterly updates and getting 100% of it done is better than reactive patching, where you only get 95 or 98% of them patched. And most attacks, even though we all worry about zero-day attacks, most attacks that actually cause real harm to real organizations are older than by far most of them are older than 3 months. I think it's technically true that most of them are older than a year, most in the sense of 50% of attacks that succeed at causing big financial harm to organizations.
That was Verizon Business Security Solutions' Peter Tippett. And that's it for this week's short format edition of Risky Business. I've been Patrick Gray. Until next week, thanks for listening.